Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. I am so excited to welcome back on our podcast, Dr. Courtney Connolly, who's not only a great friend of ours, someone who we launched a program with and we love so much, but she just released a new book called Walk. And I'm telling you, there is no better person to learn about gait mechanics and walking than Dr. Courtney Connolly. But it goes beyond just that. And there's so many fascinating things about this book. I'm so excited for you to get an insight in this podcast today. Now, she is the founder and creator of Gait Happens. This is an education enterprise that is leading the paradigm shift in foot health education and intervention, offering innovative solutions to reclaim optimal foot function and training that optimizes gait mechanics. She holds a doctorate in chiropractic medicine, as well as two bachelor's degree in kinesiology and human biology. And as a distinguished figure in the field of foot and gait specialization, she is definitely someone you're going to want to learn from. But beyond her pivotal roles at Gait Happens, Dr. Connolly is the head of patient care at Total Health Solutions and Total Health Performance, a premier healthcare destination renowned for their comprehensive and personalized approach to patient care. She is someone that truly is internationally recognized authority on foot mechanics and gait dynamics, and I'm excited for you to learn from her today. Dr. Courtney, so excited to have you back on our podcast. So for those who haven't listened to the other podcast that we had with her and Jen, you definitely need to go back and listen. So many good nuggets in there, but I am really excited because we get to dive in on your new book that you wrote called Walk, which is something so essential we do every day, probably not thinking about it. So this is a really important conversation and I'm so excited.
Thank you so much. It's so good to see you guys.
Yeah. And I mean, you guys have done a course collaboration together for some of our listeners that, you know, maybe listening, they may have done the course. So we've gotten a chance to spend some time together and chat and banter back and forth about things. And so I love doing interviews with people that I know we kind of live on that same wavelength when it comes to movement and health and rehab and taking care of the body. And I think the cool thing about this book is you also wrote that in collaboration with another physical therapist.
Yeah.
So why that partnership, and why do you think chiros and physical therapists work together so well to bring a more well-rounded picture to some of these topics?
Yeah, that's what a gift having like one of my very good friends to help me write this. The story is actually pretty funny. We were at one of our friends' weddings in Mexico, and she had known I've been wanting to write a book for some time, but the thought of actually doing it by myself was just so daunting with everything else that I had going on. And she was like, we should write that book. She's like, I'll help you write it. And I was like, all right, let's write a book about feet. And she was like, no. She's like, we were not going to write a book just on feet. I was like, really? And so we decided to write a book on walking. And it was very nice to have kind of both of our inputs moving forward, you know, her patient stories, my patient stories, how we treated very similarly, and then also different ways that we treated. So we were able to bring a lot to the table from two different professions, but also a lot of it ended up being quite similar, as you know. So it was very, very nice to have a co-author here.
Did you know that 95% of women in the perinatal stages have nutrient deficiencies? Most prenatal vitamins include bare minimum nutrition based on outdated guidance and stale research. We truly believe that you deserve to thrive and not just survive. Needed offers radically better nutrition products, education, and advocacy rooted in clinical research and practitioner validation. Needed was so instrumental in Jen and my journey to conception in her prenatal stage and postpartum. And the thing that I love about Needed is that they have nutritional supplements based on whatever stage of life you are currently in. Jen and I are still using them to this day, even though we're more than 18 months postpartum. Jen is focusing on her omegas and her CoQ10, and I take their men's multivitamin. So if you're wanting to optimize your nutrition and really get supplements that are rooted in clinical research to make sure it has the amount of nutrients that are needed to thrive, not to survive, head over to thisisneeded.com and use code OPTIMAL for 20% off your first order. That is thisisneeded.com. And make sure to use code OPTIMAL for 20% off your first order. All right, let's get back into the episode.
I mean, and that's where the overlap between chiropractic and physical therapy is so beautiful, because when people are really looking at just like the human in front of them, it doesn't matter necessarily the profession, as long as you're getting the adequate help you need to be able to address, you know, the root cause of things and what you can really do for yourself. Now, I want to unpack that just a tiny bit as well, because what do you think you guys differed on, and what do you think you guys kind of came together on within like your similarities or your differences, especially when it comes to your practice or like how you're helping people? Like what are the differences and what are the similarities? Should someone go to a chiropractor during a certain time or a physical therapist, or does it matter?
You know, when I think about that, both of us are movement oriented, right? So the foundation is always, how do we get people moving better? With my background being specific to foot and ankle, I'm very detailed. So when we were writing the book, I was like, we need a lot of detail about all of this, and we need a lot of this research. And Melissa was more big picture, like, we just need how to make this as simple as possible. And I really appreciated that, because I've been wanting to share this message on this type of platform for many years. And you can talk detail and get into all of the research, but if it doesn't resonate with an audience and people don't understand the simplicity of it, then you miss what you're trying to do. So with her being more of kind of a big mover, if you will, and me really focusing on detail, we were able to meet halfway, and that worked out well.
It's kind of like meeting halfway on the topic. You wanted to write a book about feet, and she's like, how about walking? And I'm like, you know, the foot conversation fits in there really really nicely.
Yes, that's a perfect way to look at that.
So when it comes to walking, kind of like Jen and you have both pointed out, like, something we do every day, people don't think about it. And people don't really think about walking really until later in life, when it becomes difficult, or when walking becomes something that is impeding their ability to like fulfill what they want to do in life. And I know that you refer to walking as the sixth vital sign. And, you know, our normal vital signs are things like our heart rate and our blood pressure. And walking seems to be in a little bit of a different category. So try to convince us here why walking should be considered the sixth vital sign.
Well, when you go to the doctor, right, and they take your vital signs, your blood pressure and your temperature and your oxygen saturation, those are all indicators. If something is wrong there, that they flag it. They're like, hey, something, we need to pay attention to this and do something about it now, because it could be a predictor of something going wrong in the future. So it's one of those tests or those signs where we can be proactive. The researchers who looked at walking being the sixth vital sign were saying, hey, this is very similar. And it's also very easy to assess, in that when you see someone, for example, walking slowly, and that's really what it's about, is cadence, we should be flagging that and saying, hey, why is this person walking so slowly? What's the reason for it? And what they have found, for example, is someone who has a slower cadence or less steps per minute, that can be an indicator of cognitive decline or potentially some type of dementia diagnosis. And some of the studies will tell you up to 7 years in advance. So I think that's really important, that when you're watching someone move, to be aware of how fast are they moving? Is it because they're afraid to put their foot on the ground? Is it a balance issue? Is it a strength issue? Is it a brain health or cognitive issue? And we can flag that. and say, let's start to do something about that. I think that's a very, hopeful way to look at some of these vital signs as well. It's like something, hey, let's do something about this. And, you know, as far as speed, it's, we figure out why they can't do it and we make it happen.
I mean, that is something I think, you know, people don't really get diagnosed or assessed on unless they go to physical therapy or chiropractic.
Yeah.
And they're getting those specific like timed up and go tests, and we're being able to measure that. But again, it's not at your general practitioner. It's not, you know.
Yeah. And you're talking, I mean, what you're referring to is a lot of these standardized tests, like the timed up and go, 6-minute walk test, gait speed. And we've been doing these, you know, in rehab settings, physical therapy settings for a long time. And kind of like you made reference to, there is so much data on how those things relate to and can be predictive of risk of falls, like you said, cognitive decline, mortality for that matter. So all of these tests have really robust data behind them. And like you said, if we catch this 6-7 years in advance, we can really make some change.
Right. You know, one of the things that I are with the CoLab course that we did was when we did the module on power.
Like,
I've been really researching that and looking into that. And it, like, I want people to start talking more about power.
Yes.
Like, yes, strength is important, but power is a different conversation. And you can see that in someone's gait when they lose power. You know, I was talking to my dad the other day, and he said, you know, when he went for his walk, he felt like he couldn't push off his foot, or he couldn't propel through his foot. So then the gait becomes more like this picking up and dropping it down. And it was kind of my red flag saying to my dad, hey, you're losing power at your foot and ankle.
Yeah.
You can't propel through it. You're not producing enough power to roll through your foot. And that's a problem, because when your gait is inefficient, you know, then instead of my dad saying, this is a nice walk and I'm going to go get my steps in, it becomes this laborious, like, gosh, this is kind of hard. Like, I have to, you know, maybe his hip flexor starts bothering him because he's lifting up his leg or what have you. But it's really an important conversation to that by watching someone walk, you can see how much power and efficiency they can produce.
So how do we start to address power in our feet? You know, like, how do we help to gain not only that strength, because that is a very popular conversation right now, right? Everyone is talking about strength training, but you're right. No one is talking about the speed at which we can move something, the power in which we have something. So how do we start to even, you know, potentially address, like, am I lacking power and what can I start doing today to at least start getting some fundamentals of power within my feet?
If we were to just go back to speed, for example, anybody can do this. It's how many, like, for example, see how many steps you're taking per minute. Don't try to, you know, walk faster. Just if you were outside, what would be your average steps per minute? When they look at the research for brisk paced walking, that step count should be around 130 to 135 steps per minute, which if you're not used to tracking that, I would encourage someone to try to do that. It might be a little faster than you would expect. If you want to look at power, try doing it up a hill. Because in order to maintain that speed going up terrain where your system is a little challenged, especially at the foot and ankle, you have to be able to produce power and strength to be able to maintain that speed and go up the hill. So that's kind of one way I think we can assess that, you know, at home. It's pretty easy for people to figure out. With the research too, they'll say brisk paced walking for 30 minutes. So they put a duration on there. Again, if you're not used to walking at that pace, try for that pace for 30 minutes. I think, again, people will find it's a little more difficult. When I moved, I recently moved up into the mountains a little bit. So I'm at about 8,000 feet. And I live on the side of, like, you know, a hill.
You got plenty of hills.
It was not like, and I consider myself pretty active. I was like, okay, like, we're pushing zone 2, zone 3 for 30 minutes. Like, it's, you can see how the research marries with that type of work. And then obviously, if you wanted to look at just an assessment, you could do things like calf raises, hopping, and things like that. But I think from a gait perspective, that speed is the best way to look at that. Treadmill would be like 3.5 miles per hour to 4.0.
And then just being able to like, that's how you make it better. Like do hills and force that power through your foot, force that power through your system.
Especially with walking, it's like the test ends up becoming the exercise.
Exactly.
You just do it a little more intentionally. And I think, I mean, continuing to hammer home this whole idea about power, I feel like if you ask most people about power, like you think about powerlifting, you think about all these power cleans and jerks and moving really heavy weights fast. You don't tend to think about walking or getting up out of a chair, but that is the real application of power. Once we get into our later years, is being able to push our weight more quickly. Where even the conversation about brisk walking, if you tell somebody to go out and okay, now walk briskly, people who are losing power will find that that difficult, walking briskly for any amount of time. And so if that's someone listening and it's like, oh wow, if I try to start speed walking, that's tough. And my body really kind of struggles to catch up with the idea of suddenly walking faster.
Yeah, I mean, it's power training isn't just a conversation for athletes. It's every day.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about that when I ask my patients, what do they want their later years to look like? You know, and I think there's not a person on this planet when you ask that question to that doesn't respond with, I want to be able to walk with my friends or walk with my, you know, that word always shows up, you know, because it's something that we have to be able to do. If you were to flip the script on that question, what if you couldn't walk? Then I think it invokes this sort of panic because it's, well, now we're talking, you know, are you confined to your house? You can't really do much of anything. So I think all the things that we train for in life, if you will, like power training and strength training and HIIT training and all these things really is to get us to be able to do things like walk efficiently when we age and play with our grandchildren and be able to get up and off of the floor. So the things that we do now really are just enabling us to become or maintain us as walkers as we age.
Well, and you mentioned walking efficiently. So I want to talk about that a bit because as a foot health expert, you know, what does that mean? Like, how can we more efficiently help our gait? Like, what should we be doing? Because it is impactful. And we do know, like, if we are pounding our feet, we're putting more force through our joints, it's probably uncomfortable, you know, and a lot of people for a variety of reasons will start slowing down on walking. So how can we start making it more efficient? Is it biomechanics? Is it shoes? Is it a roll of all of it? You know, can you help break it down for us?
I think it's all of it. I think we as human beings, like what defines us as a species is the fact that we are a biped and that we are able to walk on 2 feet. And we've wildly forgotten that. That's what creates our efficiency is that we are able to be upright and balanced. What allows us to be upright and balanced is what our foot feels. So we have all of these receptors on our feet that are giving us sensory information that keep us upright and balanced to be able to walk long distances. And when you look at a lot of people that are in our clinics and you watch them walk, it doesn't look fluid. You know, if someone's been in pain or they have footwear that's preventing their foot from feeling the ground or rolling through their foot, their gait looks like a struggle. And that's not efficient. You can almost see these people and you're like, this is not going to go well for a long period of time. And this is unfortunately when you hear the conversations where they'll be like, I don't want to go on my vacation to Europe because I know I'm going to have to walk around a lot and I'm not going to be able to do it. Or can you drop me off at the grocery store? Because when you park the car, I'm not going to be able to walk that far. Or drop me off at the restaurant doors. Like, these are the things that I hear in the clinic all the time. We don't want to have to live like that. So that conversation of efficiency is so much bigger. And yes, I think a lot of it comes from what your foot feels and how well it can propel you forward. So, you know, the whole footwear conversation. One of the drills we talk about in the book is rolling the earth away. So basically what that means is when you heel strike. So a walking gait is very different than a running gait. So the walking gait, you're kind of grazing the heel, and this initiates pronation, which is not a swear word. It's something we need. It's something we want. It's something that allows shock absorption. Again, creating efficiency for the rest of our body. So the heel strikes, the foot unlocks, you roll towards your big toe, and you kind of roll the earth away. There's this beautiful like thing that happens with your muscle strength and your mobility that allows this to become something that we can do over and over and over again. And that also takes its effect at the knee and the ankle and the hip and the back. So when you start interfering with those things, whether it's because of lack of strength, footwear that's restricting your function, you take away something that you're making it a lot harder on yourself. And that's not going to be efficient.
Yeah. And I think one of the struggles is that people who aren't walking efficiently have been doing things in a certain way for a long period of time.
Building in those patterns.
They've been wearing these different types of footwear for a long time. They've been walking with that specific limp or gait aberration that is due to some other sort of restriction or pain in their body. And that is where getting with someone in person can really help to suss out and create a plan as to how we're going to start walking more efficiently. One thing I saw when we were looking through the book and some of the stuff you've been talking about recently is the whole conversation around 10,000 steps a day. Jen and I work from home primarily. I would be embarrassed to tell people what our average step count is on the average day when we are getting work in and doing our thing. And then we go play with our kids and put them to sleep and we look at our phone and it's like,
hey, mine's getting better now that I have the watch.
Have I just been sitting on my hands all day long? Like, what is going on? So 10,000 steps, where does that come from? Is it something we should actually be shooting for?
It's funny that you say that because when I started researching for this book, I was like, okay, I'm getting my baseline and I'm really going to monitor this as I'm writing this book. And again, we consider ourselves pretty active. There were days when I would go into my clinic and I'm with patients all day long and I'm like, clearly I'm not sitting down. So I felt like I was like moving, but I would get home and I'm like, I have 4,000 steps today. Like, you don't realize, you think that you're, you know, moving and active, right? Because you don't have any downtime. But that repetitive action of getting step after step is, you know, often overlooked throughout our day. You know, with modern convenience comes responsibility. And I think we're kind of, you know, we've managed to get through our days pretty easily. So we need to be more cognizant of, hey, it's now the end of my day. I've only gotten 4,000 to 5,000 steps in. I need to get outside for a couple minutes. You know, so that's just a good for no matter where or how active someone is figuring out what their baseline is. The 10,000 step thing was actually interesting. It's a marketing hangover from the 1960s. So there was a Japanese company in the Tokyo Olympics who designed this. It's a Manpoke, and it literally means 10,000 step meter. So it was a marketing device that was created during the Olympics. So there isn't any science-backed research for that number. But interestingly enough, if you were to Google how many steps per day, you will still see that 10,000 marker. And when you look at the research from a longevity perspective, it actually plateaus past 10, some sources will say 10 to 11,000. So it's not that, and I want to emphasize this because I get this question a lot. It's not that getting 15,000 steps a day is bad. The maximum, the longevity research lies between 7 to 8,000 steps. So if you're getting more than that, great. My question to my patients then, if they are getting 15, 16,000 steps a day in, is, are you strength training? Are you doing VO2 max work? Are you becoming a more well-rounded, you know, well-rounded in your fitness? And if their answer to that question is no, I'm just walking, I like to have the and conversation with them.
Yeah.
That dial it down. You're still going to get the benefits of walking at the 7 to 8,000 step marker, but now give yourself some time to maybe get in the gym a couple times a week or train a little bit differently. I do think it's the and conversation rather than I'm going to walk or. Mm-hmm. I mean, we need both. You wouldn't say, are you going to sleep? Or are you going to, you know, go to the gym? It's an and conversation. And when walking is put in the same category as things like breathing and sleeping, it's much easier to process because it's a non-negotiable.
The thing with walkers, like, there are some walkers that are like cult members for walking. So if you suddenly told a walker to like, okay, cut your walking in half and now go train in the gym because we need to work on your power, they'd be like, whoa, don't tread on my walking, bad pun intended. But there are ways, as we brought up, to train power while walking.
Yes.
There are ways to do things slightly different so that you can train different aspects. Just a thought for anyone out there who may have been, you know, getting a little twitchy about thinking about cutting their walking down.
Well, in the book, we have three programs, right? So there's a base program, a build program, and a boost program. So depending upon like where we have an assessment in there to figure out where you would live. For those people where walking is your jam, right? You'd fall into the boost program. And in that program, you can do things during your walk like walking lunges. You can work on speed. You can walk up hills. So there's ways to implement, just like you said, power training and a little bit of like, you know, jumping or what have you to mix it up a little bit. And I think if you want to stay outside walking, like that's a perfect way to do it. You can get the best of both worlds.
I think especially as we age, sometimes, you know, the concept in people's mind is still wear and tear. So if I'm spending more time on my body, if I'm spending more time walking or even starting to add in different aspects to my walking and like, am I adding more load that's going to impact my joints and what I feel later on? Because like even I think of my mom and she's like, you know, oh, I have osteoarthritis because I was a runner. So I wore out my joints. Like that's, you know, and where that plays a role, like how much is that impacting? What do we need to pay attention to, especially when we're talking long term? Because we want people to keep walking. We want their speed to keep going. So how do we do that while protecting the joints?
I think the education on walking is perfect for that conversation because that's what's different about it. That's why it's something that can happen every single day at that step count because it's low load. It's low to moderate intensity. You're taking your joints through mid-range of motion. So it's not an end-range range of motion activity. So example, your big toe has 65 degrees, we'll just say. In a walking gait, it's 40 to 45 degrees. You know, your ankle dorsiflexion, 20, 25 degrees. In a walking gait, it's 10 degrees. So you're still nourishing your tissues. Right. You're still putting loads through your bones, through your muscles, through your tendons, but in a very safe, you know, environment, which is why, you know, it's the same conversation with our runners. It's like, hey, it's okay to walk, you know, switch it up a little bit, change up the load. But even for people that are concerned with wear and tear, in the book, we have a whole section on pain. That is the best thing you can do is this. Low to moderate repetitive activity with this amount of loads going through your joints, which is safe.
And I'm sure you go into more depth on this. Like it's a progressive system.
Right.
You know, we're not telling everyone out there who has pain to go and hit that 7,000 hit that 7,000 steps and make sure you get the hills in and that you're walking at a 3.5 mile an hour speed. Like,
yeah,
it's progressive and everyone's at their own stage in that journey. You also mentioned a self-assessment that you have to kind of help group people into where they might go next with their program. Can you give any little sneak peeks on what someone can do standing in their kitchen or from the comfort of their own home right now to self-assess, to get an idea of where they might have some restrictions?
Yeah, you bring up so many good points there. There's a walking assessment and also a foot assessment. So we've kind of divvied those up into where are you in your kind of walking program and where are you from a foot health perspective? On the walking side of it, this is what's really cool is, you know, I see a lot of patients in chronic foot pain and their step counts have diminished to the point where they are under 3,000, 2,500 steps per day. So the conversation that I'm having with them is very different than the conversation that I'm having with someone who's telling me they're already pulling in 8,000 to 9,000 steps per day. So we wanted it to be inclusive and it's okay no matter where you are. You know, there's a reason it's called a baseline. So you can figure out what you need to work on. The research for where a lot of the benefits of walking come into play actually are found with those who have lower step counts, because when they go from where their baseline is to increasing even say 500 steps per day, which is about 5 minutes, they decrease their all-cause mortality by 7%. So these little small increments when their baseline is low starts to have a very big impact on their overall health from a diabetes, dementia, I mean, all cardiovascular perspective. So that walking assessment, it's, you know, how many steps are you taking? How many steps are you taking per minute and figure out your baseline there? From the foot health perspective or assessment there, it's start with the basics. Do you have good toe dexterity? Can you lift your big toe? Can you lift your four toes? How does your balance look? You know, we were going to throw in calf raises in there. So how many calf raises can you do? And then throughout the book, we have these, you know, little assessments that you can do. And then also movement snacks, where at the end of each chapter, it's like, okay, if you just like you said earlier, if you can't do this, then that's what you just start doing.
Then do it.
Assessment becomes your treatment. Mm-hmm. But all things that you can do, you know, within the comforts of your home, out other than, you know, if you wanted to go walk outside.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's needed. That's the key, is breaking it down in a way for people to be able to assess and understand what's missing. What am I neglecting? What could I be improving upon? You know, and especially when we're talking about that pain conversation, I would love to dive in a little bit more specifically on shoes, because this is a big one, right? So if I am having foot pain and I'm hearing these two crazy physical therapists talking about barefoot shoes all the time, what, like, is that my goal? Is that what I'm supposed to be doing? Or am I supposed to be in the Hoka, especially if I'm having shoes? So like, what is that? What should we be paying attention to when it comes to our shoe wear?
Yeah, I really wanted to put a lot of education in the book on that, because that is that's the topic we get all the time. What kind of shoes should I be wearing?
Yes.
In the book, we talk about things that you want to look for when you're going into selecting footwear. And we also preface that with saying, throughout the book, if you've had surgery, if you have hardware in your foot, if you have arthritis to the point where your toe is restricted, these are all things that you can assess and be aware of. And then it changes the conversation of footwear. But in that book, we say, hey, if this is where you live, it's okay. This might be the shoe for you. But for most people who don't have any type of, you know, structural variant or surgical intervention, we want to have the conversation with them that you need to start paying attention to your foot. And a lot of that is what you're putting on your foot. So a lot of the footwear that is out there, traditional footwear, doesn't simply respect the anatomy of the foot. It's either too restrictive in the toe box, there's too much cushion underneath it, there's rockers on it. And for someone who has compromise, you know, like we talked about surgery, arthritis, that's when that footwear can be very beneficial. There's a time and a place. But if you wear that footwear and you don't need it, you're creating an environment where your body has to do less work. You know, and that's not what we want. Yeah. You know, there's a reason it's called a recovery sandal. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's because it's used to recover. So when I see people wearing recovery sandals, which are like the big, thick sandals, they're basically like, I'm always like, I freak out when I'm like watching people in the grocery store and I'm like, if they saw what this looks like, because it literally looks like they're like on a boat and it's rolling them through their foot. The calf doesn't have to do much. Toes don't have to do much. So these are in conversations we want to have, because if people aren't educated about this, when they put that type of shoe on their foot, they're going to be like, well, damn, this feels great.
Right. Exactly.
It does. It's moving. It's basically moving for you.
Yeah.
So, you know, nobody gets a free lunch. So yeah. That's what we wanted to really educate on, is how do I, number one, realize if I'm in this type of footwear? And number two, how do I start to transition out of it to get into a shoe where my foot can start to do more of the work? And that doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah.
You know, we'll put, people will start to transition into minimal footwear, you know, and they'll be like, my calves are sore. I'm like, yes. It'd be like if you went and squatted a lot yesterday. You'd be like, my glutes are sore. And you wouldn't say, well, I'm just not going to squat anymore. You'd be like, well, maybe I did too many, or maybe I need to decrease my weight.
Yep.
That's the conversation here. It's not that it's bad. This is what should be happening. We might need to look at dosage. Maybe you start with less time. Maybe you have to do these exercises. And that's what we have outlined, is how to get people to do this safely and to realize what happens when they get on the other end. Because it, you know, I'm probably being a little too excited about this when I say the word magical, but it is. It's, there's some magic that happens when your foot is on the ground and you feel strong from the ground up. And, you know, a lot of that is becoming just an efficient mover.
Well, and I think, you know, this is an important conversation. Even you have bunions, right?
Yeah.
And so, and do you wear barefoot shoes?
I do.
Exactly. And so I think being able to see other people who have foot elements going on and being able to say,
when you were going through the things, when you say you have foot deviations, I very high arches, plantar flexed first raise. I've also landed in the category of having a surgery. I tore ligaments in my midfoot when I was in high school, and I have hardware in my left foot. Super, super rigid foot. Not the ideal candidate for someone to be in a barefoot shoe. And being in barefoot shoes over the last 5 years was magical for me in helping me learn.
Yes, Don.
In helping me learn more about my foot and what it needs and where I have restrictions.
That's what I think is cool about it too. Like when you get your foot on the ground, it's giving you information on how you're moving. Like if you can't squat with your foot on the ground, hey, let me tease this out. Why is it? Do I need more, better pronation at my foot? Do I need more ankle mobility? Do I need more proximal stability? There are reasons. And when you don't figure out the why, then you're just chasing symptoms all over the place.
Or just relying on, you know, some shoes or inserts or insoles that you have to wear forever. Like even my cousin was told, she has a flat foot, and she was told by her podiatrist, this is the insert you're going to wear for life. Yeah, there was never going to be any kind of transition. Like, is it possible to transition out of wearing orthotics?
Yes. How I got into this was me transitioning out of my orthotics, because I wore them for very long periods of time. And I worked at a couple orthotic labs. So we were constantly like tweaking my orthotic and putting different, you know, constantly trying to like, you know, balance my foot, if you will, by all these modifications. And then I was like, what am I doing? So it was a slow transition for me. But, you know, like you said, I had a lot of foot stuff, you know, bunions and neuromas and stress fractures and the whole bit. So yes, I am a perfect example of how that can be done.
And I appreciate the amount of time you spend on this topic in the book. Like, it's multiple chapters, because when we would love to be able to give everyone the answers in a few minutes here on the podcast, it's such a nuanced conversation. And you brought up, I mean, we've been barefoot proponents for a long time, for years, better part of almost decade now. And we have people who are in the camp of, I tried barefoot shoes, they hurt my feet or calves or whatever, or to back. Some extent, or yeah. back. So they're not good for me. They're not right for me. And then we have people in the other camp who found them magical and it solved all their problems. And me, I mean, recently, it's a continual conversation. I was just introduced to Ultra by Jen, you know, your Perez, your partner in work. And like, I've now started running in Ultras and playing pickleball in Ultras, because I was trying to do those things in my barefoot shoes, my Vivos, and it just wasn't good for me, especially when I wanted to do a higher volume. And so like, continuing to find that balance that is best to support your body where it's at, like, that's what the journey's all about.
Yeah. That's exactly. One of the my favorite things we talk about in there is this concept of a shoe spectrum, because it is not this always or never conversation. It's not, I'm always going to be in a minimal shoe, or I'm never going to wear this. It's knowing, having the right tool for the task at hand. You know, we live in a man-made environment, you know, a lot, we're on cement now. That's a different conversation than walking around on dirt, especially for someone who's had a surgery or has a rigid foot. So there are times where you're going to want to have a little something under your foot, and that's okay. Like, it's not this, oh no, I have to wear this, you know, cushion underneath my foot. It's okay. You know, what we're saying is, figure out this spectrum. Sometimes put your foot on the ground. There's going to be some of you that transition into that minimal footwear, and you're going to wear it more often than not. And there will be others where, okay, I can wear that a little bit of the time, but then I have my Ultra, for example, that I'm going to wear when I'm on concrete or I'm walking in an airport or what have you. But that's an important conversation. I think the overarching theme there is that you want your foot to be in some type of functional footwear where the toes have room to splay. It's a lower heel to toe drop. I mean, we're not talking about, when I say shoe spectrum, I'm not saying, you know, walk around in a dress shoe or a high heel all day. You know, that's different. But being able to differentiate when you need what is good to know.
Okay. One last question when it comes to walking, because I think in majority of what we're talking about here is walking outside, right? What shoes do I use when I'm walking around? But walking, we also take a lot of steps in our own home.
Yes.
Hopefully. And so we're walking around our own home, and a lot of people have home shoes. Yeah. And, you know, so we're going outside and we're walking in shoes. We're inside. We're like, it's like our feet are always in something. Is this good? Is this bad? Does it depend on the material that we're walking around in on our home? Like, where is the spectrum for that?
I always say the least amount of cushion necessary to complete the task. So if you want to wear shoes at home walking around, you probably don't need this super max cushion, you know, toe spring shoe. You probably need less. Your gait is different. It's not like you're doing step after step of an intentional walk. It's more like ambient steps, right? So you're walking to do this, or you're going to do that. So that also changes what's happening at the foot. Like, for example, I have those, you know, those Bombas slippers?
Yes.
I love those. I wear my toe spacers in those. It's snowing here right now, by the way. We didn't get snow all year.
What?
And now we're getting a lot of snow right now. So
oh my God.
I have my slippers on with my toe spacers in almost May.
Yeah.
But I like that. I also have, like, you know, hardwood floors. I'm barefoot a lot, but it's nice that when I have a slipper on, but it's not a restrictive shoe. Most of us don't need this kind of restrictive shoe within the confines of our.
And I can't remember who had said it, but it was around this conversation of wearing shoes in home, or wearing a shoe with your orthotic in it in your home, because again, you're starting to develop this dependence.
Yeah.
And associated with that, starting to develop a fear of ever walking without it.
Yes.
And what they said is, if you're someone who has gotten to that point where you have developed some sort of aversion or fear to ever walking without this very supportive thing in your shoe, that's something that you should maybe look at. And that's a sign that maybe you should get with somebody and say, I want to build up more confidence in my feet so I don't feel afraid to just walk across my house to get my shoes, or walk across my house to get a glass of water. That was very telling for me. It's the whole fear of falling conversation. I'm afraid to walk without these. So if I get up and take steps and have fear in my brain and in my heart, you know, that could potentially put you at risk. We want to wrap up here, even though I know we could chat with you for forever. If somebody who's listening woke up tomorrow and did just one thing different, what would you encourage them to do?
Well, to piggyback off of what you just said, I think playing around with going barefoot or putting your foot on the ground at home is safe, right? Because you can be walking around for a couple minutes, take your shoes off, and if you're like, my heel's a little bit sore, you're in your house, grab your shoes. You know, so you can kind of play around in a safe environment of going less. You know, that's the thing that people don't think about with their foot until they can't walk on it, is the fear of getting their independence taken away.
Yeah.
You know, being able to walk on your two feet and being able to walk, period, is a freedom. And it gives us an independence. And it can be like you're a prisoner in your own body when you can't put your foot on the ground. So, you know, that's what I really am hoping with this book, is to encourage people. It's a hopeful conversation. It's an empowerful conversation that, regardless of if you've been in foot pain for a while or if you have bunions, or there is no better time than now to take your shoes off. And if that means in your house, put your foot on the ground. Feel what it's like to actually get different inputs from the ground up. And then as you start to get comfortable, then you can play around with getting different types of footwear and taking walks outside with footwear that you have to work a little harder in, which is okay. It's an environment where you will get stronger. The dosage is what we need to talk about. So yes, that's always my kind of, you know, mix it up a little bit, take your shoes off, and then pay attention. You know, just pay attention to your foot like you would the rest of your body, because when something happens there, it does affect the rest of your body, and we don't want to take it for granted.
Literally, it's our foundation. So I'm so grateful for this conversation, for the book. I think it's going to be so educational for people, eye-opening in ways of doing some of the assessments and understanding the movement snacks that people can start adding in. So I'm so, so excited for people to get this in their hands. Where can they find it? Where can they order it and start learning more about it?
You guys are awesome. Thank you so much. I know I've said this to you both a million times, but your support means the world to me. It is on every Amazon. You can get it on our website, on Gate Happens. So Barnes & Noble, like all of your book outlets, you will be able to order this on. And it's you can pre-order it now.
We'll have that all linked up. And I mean, Courtney, as always, great to chat. I know we're going to get to see you in person relatively soon. So that's always exciting. And thanks for your time.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
Thanks for sticking around. Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Conley as much as we did. We love chatting with her and taking in all of her expertise on the feet, and specifically gait, and how important that can be to our movement longevity. And with movement longevity in mind, Dr. Jen and Doc Conley are actually doing a free live webinar helping you assess your movement longevity. You can find the link for that down in the show notes. So come join them for that. And we will see you next time on the Optimal Body Podcast.